Good afternoon. I'm Philip A. Less, registration 3440, representing the appellant, Carl Johnson. Please the court, counsel. There are, I think, five issues I'd like to talk about. This is a divorce case. The first is property equalization calculation that the trial court conducted. The second was a failure to consider a significant financial circumstance with respect to some resort property that the parties owned. The third has to do with the determination of the threshold for an award of maintenance. The fourth has to do with an amount of maintenance that the court awarded, and the last has to do with the division of some personal property. With respect to the property equalization, the parties owned a corporation known as JCP Financial. That was owned by the husband and wife. They both worked there. It was in effect for 25 years. At the time of the divorce, there was a joint appraiser retained by both parties named Ron Cook. He appraised the value of the business as a going concern, essentially for both parties, came up with a figure of $284,396. The parties talked about this, agreed that that was a fair value for the company, agreed that the husband would retain the company, and that the value for the purpose of the property division would be the appraised value as determined by Mr. Cook. That agreement, that stipulation, was read into the record. The trial court approved that stipulation. At the end of the case, the court determined a balance sheet for a property division. The court decided that an equal property division would be fair, and so a balance sheet was provided to determine if there was a property equalization payment required. In constructing the balance sheet, however, the trial court included the corporate bank account of some $71,000 and also two vehicles that were owned by the corporation having a value of $9,000. This was in conflict with the stipulation, which was basically the husband's going to get the entire company for that value, and there was no separation of any assets out of the company. There were a number of assets in the company, but for whatever reason, the court separated out the bank account and the vehicles. We believe that that was a mistake of fact, a clear error, a factual error, because basically it had the effect of double counting those assets by including them in the $284,000 figure and then re-adding them into the balance sheet.
Mr. Less, let me ask you this question, because my understanding is your opposing counsel has pointed out that the same separation was apparent in Wife's Exhibit 10-1, and that was admitted at trial with the agreement of husband, and that there was no objection to the separating out of the account from the actual valuation of the business, and then therefore that would, in essence, constitute a waiver that this issue isn't preserved for appeal. So I would like your response to that.
What happened was there was an exhibit notebook, and we agreed to certain exhibits being admitted. On this particular exhibit, however, I made it clear to the trial court that we were not allowing this to be admitted as evidence, but only as a visual aid with respect to the property division position that was going to be taken by the wife. So, and that's in the record, and I've made reference to it in my brief. So that was a visual aid. That was not evidence. That was essentially argument. And this is used commonly in trial court situations where you refer to your client and say, is this the way you want the property divided? Look at Exhibit A, look at Exhibit B, whatever it might be. So there was a specific statement that was made at that time that I was not allowing that to be admitted as a factual exhibit, as evidence. And the court accepted that, said that's fine. The other issue with respect to that has to do with the $71,000 amount. The $71,000 amount was found in a bank statement, but the bank statement was approximately four months previous to the hearing, which meant that it wasn't the right value. And the husband testified that the current bank account at the time of the decree was $30,000 approximately. So to use a $71,000 figure of a previous balance of the bank account would have been wrong, in error, even if it was appropriate as a part of the balance sheet calculation. So our position is that the balance sheet was not calculated properly and the property equalization was not proper, so that that has to be redone, backing out those other assets. The second issue has to do with the failure to consider totality of financial circumstances. This is the resort property in Michigan. That was another family business, in fact, for 15 years. It had historically operated at a loss. The 2011 loss based on the tax return was like about $82,000 for the year. The court ordered the sale of that resort, but did not enter an order as to who would maintain those expenses, the expenses of this business. That is a significant financial circumstance, since it totals about $82,000 a year. And since the court did not enter any kind of an order as to who pays it, really there's no way to determine the rest of the property division or any maintenance issues in this case until the totality of the circumstances are considered.
Well, Mr. Less, let me ask you a question. With our review on appeal, my understanding is that the court found that husband's testimony regarding those losses were not credible. So are we stuck with the court's finding there, or can we actually review this issue as far as the losses of that the resort?
Your Honor, my understanding is somewhat different. My understanding is that what the court found to be not credible was my client's document that he had prepared as an exhibit that projected the income of the corporate entity to the next year. And that is the document he found to be not credible. I don't believe that he found that there was a credibility issue with respect to the tax return, which was admitted into evidence without objection, showing an $82,000 loss. That's a tax return, and it was admitted, and there's nobody that ever contested it. So I believe that's uncontradicted evidence. And I don't believe the court made a finding that this corporation was not operating at a loss, and then also made no finding as to who would pay that loss, who would pay those ongoing expenses of the operation of this business. The other issue with respect to the resort has to do with the question of a licensed appraiser and the court making a decision that the court would not accept the licensed appraiser's opinion of value, which was $130,000. There was no other evidence presented, credible evidence of any value, but the court rejected that because the court found it to be not conceivable that one could invest more in a property than what they would get out of it when it was sold.
And so isn't the court free to reject the testimony of an expert witness?
I think the court can certainly do that if appropriate findings are made and if it is not manifestly an arbitrary rejection. But here the rejection was based upon a situation being inconceivable that somebody could put that money into a property and then lose it, which I think has an arbitrary characteristic to it, but it's also contrary to common experience based upon the economic circumstances. And so rejecting that appraisal, I think, was an issue. But in addition, the first right of refusal, which was 5 days of listing price determined by a realtor, we believe is unfair because here the court is rejecting a licensed appraisal's value and now is going to say we're going to have a realtor do a value. We're going to accept that value for the purpose of a first right of refusal, but the party has to buy the property within 5 days after the realtor determines what the listing price is, instead of determining if somebody's willing to buy it at what price. So we feel that was unfair. As far as the maintenance threshold, I think this comes down to a couple of things. One is, to determine the threshold of maintenance, the wife's reasonable needs must be determined. And this was not done in this case. In addition to that, we have to determine the standard of living of the marriage. Now, there was specific evidence as to the standard of living. The standard of living came from what were called the green sheets. They were specific documents prepared by the wife during the marriage showing the expenses of the family. And they showed that the family spent about $50,000 a year for a family of four. That was their standard of living. The court reviewed the green sheets, accepted them, and found that this was a middle-class family, middle-class lifestyle, not extravagant. And so that was the court's finding on standard of living, but the court did not go the next step to say, what is the wife's reasonable needs based upon that standard of living? So the problem of the earning capacity of the wife of $50,000, which the court also accepted from the testimony of the employment evaluator, and the standard of living of $50,000 for a family of four, results in an unreconcilable order based upon those findings. So if you have somebody that has an earning capacity of $50,000 and a standard of living of $50,000 for a family of four, how can you reconcile that the maintenance threshold has been met, particularly if you don't have any finding as to the wife's reasonable needs? I just don't see how that can be done, Your Honor. As far as the maintenance amount, this creates another problem. To determine the maintenance amount, again, you have to have findings of the wife's reasonable needs so you can determine how much she needs and how much she's short from her earnings. What the court found was the wife's earning capacity is $50,000. Also went on to say that the wife could be employed quickly. He awarded the rental property with an income of $28,000 to the wife and maintenance of $30,000. If we add the wife's earning capacity, the rental property income and the maintenance totals $108,000. If we look at the tax returns, we see that the one corporation, the JCP Financial, has never earned profit of $108,000. So the wife has been awarded more money than this company has ever earned. And so on the face of it, there's a conflict. But we don't know what the wife's reasonable needs are because there was no finding made by the court with respect to that. The other issue that is also here has to do with the husband's ability to pay. Here the court said, I don't know what the husband's income is. If I don't, it's his own fault, because the court rejected that document that was mentioned earlier, and so then imputed income to the husband of $10,000 per month. Once again, the tax return doesn't justify that, and neither does the Ron Cook's report that established income for this company. So there is no support in the record with respect to the husband's ability to pay $10,000 per month, and in fact, the evidence is all to the contrary. But without the wife's reasonable needs, again, a maintenance amount really can't be determined. But if you have a $50,000 standard of living for a family of four, and you have income awarded to the wife with maintenance of $108,000, it just doesn't fit. It doesn't work. Finally, we have a personal property issue, fairly straightforward. The husband received certain items from his family. It was inherited property. The evidence is not in dispute. It was not a gift to the marriage. No finding was made. And that property needs to be awarded to the husband. Again, a clear error, mistake of fact, with respect to what the evidence reflected. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mr. Les, you have a couple minutes left.
May it please the court. Your Honor, Catherine Ellis, number 39356, on behalf of the appellee wife in this case. Your Honor, the trial court in this case was faced with the unfortunate position of having to value assets and award spousal maintenance without sufficient credible evidence before it. It's wife's position that the trial court did the best that it could with the evidence presented to it, that all of the issues husband has raised on appeal involve questions that fall within the trial court's discretion, and that the trial court in this case did not abuse that discretion in entering the orders that it did. As a preface to wife's argument, we would first note that it's a well-established principle that this court will defer to the trial court's findings regarding the credibility of evidence and witnesses, and that makes sense because the trial court, who's the finder of fact in this case, is in the best position to decide whether those witnesses' testimony is accurate, straightforward, and honest. In addition, it's a well-established principle that it's the responsibility of the parties to provide the trial court with the facts that it needs to make these decisions. If the parties fail to do that, we can't fault the tribunal for not knowing the reality of the situation. These parties had the opportunity to conduct discovery. They did, in fact, conduct discovery, and they were allowed to present evidence at trial. The fact that husband didn't present evidence upon which the court could make the determinations it needed to make should not now be used as a basis to tell the trial court that it made an error in this case.
Ms. Ellis, let me ask you a question based on what Mr. Less had just said, that the court may have rejected one of the documents that husband had provided, but it did not reject the tax return or Mr. Cook's report with regard to, say, the nature of the loss of the resort, I believe with the amount of maintenance and how husband's income would have been affected by that. So I'd like you to respond to that.
Sure. The trial court clearly found that husband's testimony regarding the business and the income from the business was not credible, and its findings on that were rather scathing. With regards to the resort, the permanent orders don't contain explicit findings. We would agree that the resort losses were inappropriate, inaccurate, or anything like that. However, the court also ordered the sale of the resort, and the assumption would be that those losses wouldn't continue if the property were sold. In addition, the fact that there may be losses pending that sale and that those specific costs may not have been ordered with regards to who should bear that expense is not an error or an oversight that would justify undoing the entire property division or the maintenance division. That would be a simple factor that the parties could resubmit to the court for additional findings or orders. Neither party did so. And we don't know the impact on appeal of that error because we don't know whether the resort sold a week after the hearing, whether it's still pending a sale. We don't know what the actual cost of that would be. Those would also be things that, in theory, could be taken into consideration when the property was sold. If the property were ultimately sold for $300,000 and one of the parties had advanced $40,000 or $50,000 in dealing with that, that would be something the parties could then take into account as they're determining what the actual proceeds of that sale would be. But there isn't evidence before this court that the failure to clearly designate who's going to pay those expenses in the interim would render the underlying property division inequitable or make the maintenance award inappropriate. With regards to the JCP financial property, husband's counsel indicated that the trial court did not construct the balance sheet appropriately, that when it was constructing the balance sheet, it made an error. And counsel would remind this tribunal that it was not the trial court who constructed anything. Wife's attorney prepared this balance sheet, husband's attorney stipulated to its admission. And while husband's counsel is correct that husband did not necessarily agree to the division proposed therein, husband certainly approved the admission of a document that itemized the bank account and the business as separate items to be included and divided. And the record is lacking any information that husband sought to correct that oversight or to even characterize it as an oversight. There's not testimony or a counter exhibit prepared that would indicate that that bank account should not have been taken into consideration as separate property. In addition, the valuation itself does not make clear that the bank account must be included in the value of the business. The evidence before the court was actually that the amount of money in that bank account varied significantly over time. The figures fluctuated in 1 month between $29,000 and $65,000. At one point, that account had as much as $73,000 in it. The amount assumed at the time of the valuation was somewhere around $30,000 that stayed in there regularly, but it's not clear how much that fluctuation and the actual balance of that account mattered in determining the value of the business as a separate entity. In addition, husband contests the amount of money that was the value of that bank account at the time of the trial, and yet husband himself offered no more updated statements. The most recent statement for that bank account that was offered to the court was from June of 2012. The hearing took place in October. The June statement indicated that there was approximately $70,000 in that bank account, not the $30,000 that husband testified to. And given the trial court's other findings regarding husband's credibility as to the business testimony, it's not inconceivable that the trial court did not find husband's testimony that account was now worth less than half what the most recent statement indicated credible. Even if that bank account should have been included as part of the business, the court did not award that entire account to Wife. Instead, it used it as a way of accomplishing an equalization in this case. And there's certainly nothing in the existing law that would require the court to give an asset in its entirety to a party. The trial court has the discretion to decide whether to parse up property and carve out pieces of property for the different parties. As a example, if the court were awarding the house, the marital residence, to one party, it could certainly, within its discretion, decide husband keeps the house, but wife gets the washer and dryer. They're attached to the house. Most people would value them when deciding a sale price of the house, but the court could still decide part of that property should be cordoned off for the other party as a way of equalizing the assets.
Can you respond to husband's argument, though, that the court here actually double counted as far as the balance sheet?
And Your Honor, there's two responses to that. One, that we don't know that that's the case because it's not clear from the valuation itself that the entire value of that bank account was a necessary part of determining the value of the business, nor do we know how much the bank account affected the overall valuation of the business. And the parties didn't provide testimony from the valuator, so there's not any way to determine that on this record. Second, again, we'd fall back on the argument that on some level, that is an invited error because husband didn't seek to correct that discrepancy at the trial court level. He had an opportunity when wife was presenting a document that husband stipulated could be admitted that said the bank account and the business are separate items, and he didn't take that opportunity. He didn't tell the trial court, wait, there's a mistake here. One of these items has already been counted. Regarding the resort sale, the court, to Your Honor's question, clearly has the discretion to decide whether an expert's testimony or any witness's testimony is credible and has the right to reject whatever evidence is in front of it on the basis of credibility. The trial court did make findings here. This was not a frivolous decision by the trial court to reject the appraisal out of hand. The logic that the trial court included in the written order was that, in the trial transcript was that these parties had purchased this property for $315,000, that they had invested something like $750,000 in the property. And the trial court simply did not find credible the idea that a piece of property with that much investment in it could now be worth less than half of the original sales price. In addition, when the trial court pushed back on both attorneys and the parties and said, how do I solve this? If I don't find the appraisal credible, if I don't believe that this piece of property, this acreage on Lake Michigan, is worth only $130,000, what do I do? Wife's counsel offered a solution. Wife's counsel said, if you don't find you can value this property accurately, then order the sale and order the proceeds be split, because that will still accomplish an equitable division of property. If the rest of the property is divided roughly equally and you order this divided equally, that will still result in an equitable division, even if it's not ideal that one of the parties then can't keep and maintain this property. Husband's counsel, when asked the same question, also acknowledged that that may be the only remedy the court had available. The husband's counsel included some language about, well, maybe you could have them listed for sale just to solicit offers and then use those offers to allow one of the parties to buy the other one out. But at base, there was still that idea that if we don't know what the value is, let the market decide. Let the market determine what the value of that property is, because that seems like the only way to get a fair resolution to that question in the face of incredible testimony presented by both parties regarding the value. Because remember, the trial court also rejected wife's testimony as to how she arrived at a value because she couldn't explain her methodology. And the trial court said, I'm not sure I understand how you came up with this value either. The trial court said neither party did their job here, so we're going to have to order a sale instead. There's case law that supports that solution to the problem in a very similar situation that the trial court relied upon. That decision in Re the Marriage of Weaver provides us with an answer. When you have an unusual property and the value is hard to determine, it makes sense to sell the property and order the proceeds be shared. With regards to spousal maintenance, the trial court here definitely made findings that wife needed support. There's in fact a section of the permanent orders titled Threshold Determination of Eligibility, where the court analyzes why, even with the property the court was awarding to wife, it believed wife needed additional support. And the court concluded that wife's current unemployment, the fact that she'd been out of the market for quite a long time, had been responsible for caring for the house and children for quite a while, and had really only been working for husband's business in recent memory, justified giving wife a temporary period of maintenance to reestablish herself in the community. That's what the court did here. This is a 27-year marriage, and the court only ordered 5 years of maintenance. It did that with the idea that this was rehabilitative, that wife should be able to get back on her feet and find employment, and this was supposed to give her a bridge to get back into that market. Because the court ordered the maintenance and it was not stipulated by the parties, it's absolutely modifiable. And had wife acquired a job within a short time frame that ratcheted her income upward, had husband been unable to meet his needs, either one of these parties could have gone back and asked the court to modify its maintenance order to accommodate those new circumstances. The court made that threshold determination, and the court went through the analysis that's required when deciding the amount of spousal maintenance. The court listed all the statutory factors, it included findings regarding each of those factors, and it applied them to the specific facts in this case. The court, unfortunately, again, was stuck with the lack of credible evidence regarding husband's income, which made determining the amount of income or the maintenance difficult. Notably, wife was requesting that the court find husband's income be $18,000 a month. Husband was requesting it be somewhere around $4,000 a month. And the trial court essentially split the difference. The number the trial court came up with was $10,000, roughly halfway in between, actually slightly closer to husband's number than wife's. And the trial court based that, as it says in the written order, on all of the financial documents in front of it, including the tax returns, including the JCP financial records, including bank records, and whatever else it had in front of it to determine what that income level was. The court here has significant concerns about husband's credibility regarding his income, and that needs to be noted when considering this record. We're not faced with a position where this court has the ability to determine whether it believes husband. We're faced with a situation in which the trial court undisputedly found that husband's income was not credible, that his arguments did not make sense regarding his income, and the trial court had to come up with a number that it believed husband was actually earning. Among the things the trial court had issues with were husband's bookkeeping and the fact that he included things like the temporary order's spousal support as contract labor, as something like $4,000 a month that was stripped off of what his business income looked like because he was reflecting it as contract labor instead of his spousal maintenance obligation. And on the final issue, Your Honor, counsel has argued that there was an error here because the trial court did not make any findings regarding this property being marital property and that it was undisputed that these items were gifts. That's simply not the case. In the record, this was a disputed issue. It was undisputed that these items came from husband's family, but it was disputed as to whether they were gifts, whether they were separate or marital property. We see that in wife's testimony wherein she discussed the idea that many of these items were things that they fixed up and had to add value to, that the other family members wanted back, that she didn't clearly believe and would not accept on cross-examination the description of that property as gifts.
Ms. Ellis, was the court required to make findings, though, as to which of those items, I believe in Exhibit 9, were marital and which were separate?
The trial court has an obligation to decide whether property is separate or marital, absolutely, and here the trial court did. The trial court made a finding in the written order that all of those items are marital property subject to division. Once it's made that finding, it then has to decide how to equitably divide them. And here, since the court noted no one gave the court any information regarding the value of those items, the court said, the best thing I can think is take turns choosing items, and hopefully the two of you will sort out what you think they're worth, and that will result in an equitable division. So again, Your Honors, faced with a lack of credible evidence presented by the parties, the trial court came up with a solution that is within its discretion. Thank you.
Very briefly, Your Honors, counsel, I think, is relying on the court's discretion, the trial court's discretion, but I would point out that the trial court really doesn't have discretion to ignore a stipulation after accepting it. And I believe that we did severely address the balance sheet, which basically counsel for the wife was suggesting was an appropriate property division. We rejected that. We objected to it in the time, at the time of permit orders argument. The court also has no discretion to value an asset at a value on a date other than the permit orders hearing. That's clear. The court does not have the discretion to fail to consider the totality of financial circumstances and who is to pay these expenses. The sale of this property could be pending for years and years. It is a financial circumstance. It's real. The court has no discretion to fail to make findings on the reasonable needs of a spouse requesting maintenance. That's essential. That's required. I think I cited four cases in the brief on that. And the court does not, cannot award an amount of maintenance that exceeds the husband's source of income as shown on his tax returns, and in this case, in Mr. Cook's report. So we would submit that in some cases, the court does not have a discretionary issue here. In many others, it was abused.
Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. This